Hey, this is Evan Longoria of your San Francisco Giants, and you're listening to TortureCast.
You're listening to a podcast by and for fans of the three-time world champion, San Francisco Giants. Let's go, Giants! With hosts Chad King and Eric Nathanson. This is TortureCast.
It's Monday, March 15th, 2021, and this is episode 216 of the TortureCast, the podcast by and for fan of the San Francisco Giants. I'm your host, Chad King, and joining me today, as always, Eric Nathanson. What's up, man?
Hey, Chad. Not much. Just more baseball. Happy to be back on a regular swing of things. The weather's turning nicer. You know, the sun's out for an hour long. I got to tell you, I'm a big fan of this daylight spring forward thing. I was sitting outside for an extra hour last night. I didn't have to worry about getting cold. And it was nice. So gearing up for spring. How's things up north?
Yeah, it's always tough, especially with the kids. They lose that hour. Well, I mean, we all do. I love it because we get the extra hour in the afternoon. Obviously, that's fantastic. But, you know, it's hard because the kids, in fact, my 11-year-old last night asked, "Well, Dad, if we got an extra hour today, that means we can go to bed an hour later tonight, right?" I was like, "Well, we could, but you still got to wake up at the same time. So you lose an hour of sleep, bud. That's how it works." Yeah. And he's like, "What? I don't get it." So sometimes it's even still hard for some of us to grasp. But yeah, it's nice having the sunset instead of it. You know, a few months ago, it was at 5 o'clock. Now it's going to be like 7:30 tonight. So it allows us to get outside, be active a little bit longer. Although I did go to CrossFit this morning, and it's an 8:30 class. And, you know, the sun is usually in a general position over the last few weeks. And it was really, really cold this morning. Everybody's like, "Why is it so cold? Why are we in the shade? We're usually in the sun." And I was like, "Oh, it's because it's like 7:30 in the morning, like what it used to be, you know?" And they're like, "Oh, yeah, that's it." I'm like, "Yeah, it's going to be a little bit colder in the morning. It's going to get lighter a little later in the morning." So, but hey, we're all good. The Giants are enjoying the weather down in Scottsdale, and that's what we're here to talk about. So so far the Giants are now 6-5 this spring, 2 weeks left of spring training. And you know, usually I can get along with spring training just fine. I enjoy it. Usually have the ability to go down there. At least I know people who go down there. This spring it's kind of like, let's just get to the regular season, man. I just want to go. I don't know about you, but it's like, I know I don't want to rush things because of COVID, but at the same time, I just want to get going, man. I want to see the games count, because right now, especially with the weird rules and, oh, let's play 5 innings, let's play 7 innings. Let's stop this inning because we hit the pitch count. The 9th inning, we're not going to have any umpires. They just left, so we're going to call the game. Like, really weird things like that have happened where, I mean, these games never counted before. They really don't count now. And I just like, okay, let's just get on with it. Let's just get going.
Yeah, I'm at that point too. I think part of it too is not having any real televised games. It's kind of frustrating because it's like we know what's going on, but we don't even get to watch it at the time. This week we're lucky. We get 2 games, Tuesday and Thursday night. We get Kruk and Kipe. But I'm totally with you. The weirdness, I've had enough of it. Like, I was watching the Cubs game the other day, and they're like, "Well, we're going to play 7 innings." And then in the 7th inning, they're like, nope, now we understand we're going to play 8 innings. And it's like, they don't even know going into it. There was the 22 pitch at bat the other day.
That was so much fun. Yeah.
It was. I watched it live. I happened to be watching that game. And because, you know, I'm craving baseball. And it was amazing. It was the first batter Jordan Hicks had faced in 2 years. And when they came out to get him, the 3-batter minimum was back into play. So they had to fake an injury. So the manager came out to take him out. And then the umpires are like, "Whoa, wait a second. We have the 3-batter rule. You need to call your trainer." So they like waved the trainer out. The guy walked out, immediately turned back around with Hicks and walked back into the dugout. You know it was fake. And nobody cared.
Oh, yeah. Nobody cared. Yeah.
But
I mean, even the umpires at that point are like, "Yeah, dude had a 22 pitch at bat. What are you going to do?" So.
Right. I think they actually gave him the idea. I think they're the ones who told him you have to fake you have to fake an
He
injury.
might have. I saw him grab his arm there for a second. Yeah.
Right. Let's just make this all kosher for MLB. But it's I'm so ready for regular baseball. And now that they've started to pare down the team and get an eye towards who they want on the opening day roster, it makes it a little more real too.
Yeah, let's speak about that. I just kind of showed on the screen there, got a couple of screens showing the cuts. You alerted me to this. I had missed this morning. But yeah, this morning they have assigned 25 players to minor league camp, reducing their spring roster from 74 to 49. So the 40-man players optioned included pitchers Kervin. Is it Kervin? I thought it was Kep. I guess it is Kervin. Castro, Camila Duvall, Connor Menez, Gregory Santos, catcher Joey Bart, and catcher Trump, outfielder Canario, and outfielder Jalen Davis. After that, we have non-roster invitees reassigned. Pitchers Alvarez, Tristan Beck, Tyler Sir, Matt Frisby, I love that name, Luis Gonzalez, Sean Gelly, Jay Jackson, Kaiwei Tang, Sam Wolf, catchers Patrick Bailey and Ricardo Genovese. And then also includes infielders Alcantara, Marco Luciano, which, these are all expected. Will Wilson, Logan Wyatt, outfielders Bisabe and Hunter Bishop. So you kind of explained to me a little bit what's going on with names like Bart and Trump, because we're all thinking, well, wait a minute, they need one of those guys, don't they?
Yeah, that's what the interesting thing is about this spring training, that these guys needed to be cut because if they were still on the quote unquote major league roster past a certain date, which I believe tomorrow is the date, then if they got hurt, they would be guaranteed major league contracts for the year. So by sending them down, the Giants avoid that. These players are still able to play in spring training games. Specifically because the AAA does not have a spring training going right now. It's just starting until the beginning of April when everybody gets out of town. So these guys, the only thing that really happens to these guys is they lose major league meal money. That's it. Other than that, they're still going to train with the team. They're going to play on the backfields. They're going to play in games, as evidenced by Trump starting today. So, I mean, it doesn't just leave Posey and Casale as the only two catchers for the next 2.5 weeks. They are able to all still play in games. What it does mean is that none of these guys are going to be on the opening day roster. So any hopes that anybody had an outside chance of like a Luciano getting there, that's not happening. But there's certain names like Jalen Davis that's who surprised me. I didn't expect him to necessarily be sent down. I thought he would get more looks. And now I understand, like I just explained, he's going to get reps, but I thought Davis would just, have a shot at the opening day roster. But I guess with the way Duggar's been playing, he's not going to necessarily stay in that. So that was the first round of cuts that the Giants have. They went from 74 to 49. I think I lost Chad. I'm still live. I'm going to check to see if I'm still live
And
right
I,
now.
it cut me out. Yep, we're
I
still
did.
live.
Okay.
Yeah,
I don't know if
you
I
hear me?
lost you. Yes.
Yeah, no, it was a my fault. It was a fat fingers there. So my apologies, everyone. But we're back. We're live.
So what did I say? They're down from 74 to 49. So that means
Yeah,
they still
74 to
need to get down.
49.
Yeah, they still need to get down another 23 guys before they break camp, which is still a whole heck of a lot. So there's still a lot on tap. This is just the first round. We're gonna see bigger cuts and bigger decisions made in the next 2 weeks.
Right. Also, forgot to mention at the top of the show, because I'm still getting used to this, we are actually streaming this live on Facebook. For those of you already on Facebook, you know this. For those of you on the audio podcast later, if you're ever on around noon, 12:15 Pacific time on Mondays, that's generally when we're going to be streaming this live on Facebook. We will also always have the video recording up on Facebook after it, and then eventually embedded on our website at torturecast.com, where you can also get the audio version of our podcast, as well as most of your favorite podcast feeds, including Apple and Spotify and Google, Stitcher, and many other places. So, anyway, Sorry, I just forgot to do that. So what I had done is I had my screen share up, and I thought I was on that tab, and I hit the back button. It backed me out of the
Oh.
studio instead because I was on the StreamYard thing. So that was a producer fail there. For those of you listening to the audio, wondering what the hell happened, but we're back. We're still going live here.
I try to keep talking for, a little bit just to keep that up for those that were just listening.
Yeah, Brooks is like, come back, Chad. Yeah, I disappeared. I was like, enough of this Giants talk.
You are ready
All
for the
right.
season.
I am. So, Buster Posey, of course, opted out of the 2020 season, and he's back this year. Of course, last year it was to take care of his newly adopted twins. Really, commendable reason for doing so. He certainly doesn't have any regrets. It was a shortened season. He was able to kind of rest up. I know he talked about throwing diapers, which is kind of funny, in terms of keeping his arm in shape. But I wanted to go ahead and play a portion of his interview over the weekend. Actually, the MLB Network profiled the Giants in one of their 30 to 30 for 30 days, 30 clubs in 30 days, and of course they interviewed Buster Posey. So why don't I go ahead and play that for you right now.
And John and I are pleased to be joined by the Giants, a superstar, Buster Posey, right now. Buster, Fran Charles, and John Smoltz, thanks for joining us. So, were you having any issues just getting reacclimated with the spring training facility in Scottsdale? What's it like for you being back with the team this year after opting out last season?
Yeah, it's been good. It's been good to be back on the field. I think playing as long as I have now, everything's come back pretty quickly. I think that my body trying to acclimate, but that holds true for every spring. But no, it's been good. Like a couple of weeks into games and getting closer and closer to that start date.
Buster, I can say you look younger, so that's a good thing. When the game was taken away from me for injury reasons, I really appreciated things that maybe I took for granted, with Tommy John being out all year. Is there a part of things that you appreciated, whether it's mentally, whether it's a refresh, that the game was, for obvious reasons, a shorter season, but you were out? What have you learned in that time away from the game that maybe you wouldn't have learned had you not been?
Yeah, I mean, I guess I could speak on just the appreciation aspect of it. I mean, for me, I've missed probably the simple things more than anything, just playing catch. And I've always liked to practice and, just the preparation of getting ready to play the game. The game's kind of the icing on the cake, but all the work and the grind that goes into getting ready for the game is something that sometimes I think when you're in the middle of it, you might not as enjoy as much, but when it's gone, you realize that you actually do enjoy that part of it a lot.
And Buster, from a life perspective, I mean, take people through a little bit of what last year was like for you, because I know you adopted the twin girls, and so Lee and Addison, they have new sisters at home, and basically being able to be at home, I mean, for the year with your wife and your family.
Yeah, it was that was a silver lining for sure, was being able to have some extra time with them. I mean, like everybody else, life was different, right? I mean, it wasn't normal under the circumstances of the pandemic that we're all living through. But yeah, I mean, I think really just trying to cherish that time I had with extra time with the older kids, and then being there with the birth of the twin girls, and just getting to experience those first few months of their life was special.
I had the luxury of playing for Bobby Cox for 21 years. You played pretty much for one manager your whole career. Now it's different and a change. How much of that change in philosophy and and how you adapt to a different regime had you had to look into this year? Like, what are the major differences? Because you were comfortable with one manager for the most part of your career.
Yeah, I mean, there's definitely changes. I think, my time with Boch was great, and a lot of great memories. And like anything else, I think that with baseball, you've got to be able to adjust. And I think this new staff and Kapler brought some different and new ideas. And you try to meld together what you've learned from the past with maybe what some ideas they're bringing, and apply it as best as you can. And ultimately, the goal is still trying to win baseball games. So I think taking that simplistic mindset is what's always worked for me. It's just, what can I do to try to help the team win?
You've worked with some fantastic pitchers throughout your career. Give me your thoughts on Kevin Gausman. How excited are you to get busy as you guys kind of learn each other a little bit here during spring training and then get it going here in the regular season?
Yeah, I caught him quite a bit last spring, and then caught him. I've caught him once in a game this year, and man, his stuff is as good as it gets right now. But I think what's impressive about him right now is there's a lot of guys with great stuff in the game, but his command has been great with several different pitches, and those are the elite pitchers, the ones that have the stuff and the command, and he definitely has that right now.
Buster, the game is better when you're in it, so we're happy to have you back, and thanks for spending a little time.
All right. Well, interesting thoughts there. I wanted to go ahead and play the whole interview because it was about 4 minutes in length, so I know it was a little long. But I thought it was interesting at the end there where he was talking about Gausman and how obviously we know his stuff is good, but he was talking about his command being very good right now. But other than that, Eric, I mean, what do you expect from him this year? I mean, do you think having a year off is going to help him, hurt him? Do you think it's irrelevant because of his age? I mean, what do you think? What's your expectations for Buster Posey this year?
My expectations are definitely higher than how he played in 2019. I think it's the best stepping stone to go with. If I expected us to see 2016 Buster Posey, 2015 Buster Posey, I'd say it. I'm not sure anything points to that just yet. Even his spring numbers are just kind of mess so far. So I think anything better than he played in 2019 would be a positive. Mm-hmm. And I think just for the team as an overall whole, him coming back, being on the plate, working with different pitchers, you know, they asked him about Gausman specifically. And I found Gausman's interview during that 30 and 30 to be interesting as well, because he talked about archery and how he has to zero in on the target and how he's learning that the longer you look at your target before you release the ball, the better he seems to do. At least, you know, that works out for him, and it worked because from archery and how long he looks at target. So you got to wonder if like new wrinkles like that are things Buster keeps up with and works with the pitching staff. And I expect that those are things that he kind of runs with. You know, he mentioned things are a little different with the new staff compared to Bochy's staff. And right. There's probably new wrinkles like that he's going to get adjusted to. And I think if Buster's on board with everything, then it'll show in his production. Because, you know, the guy talked about how much he enjoys practice and preparation. So if he's doing all those things, you'd like to think it's going to show. I mean, and you'd like to. I can't help but be optimistic about Posey. Being pessimistic just feels wrong.
It just feels wrong. Yeah, it's I don't know who it was. I want to say it was Brian Kenny of MLB Network. It might have been him. About a week or two ago, they reviewed his candidacy for the Hall of Fame and how close or how far he is from that Hall of Fame vote. And it was really interesting because it's a fairly objective point of view. And I won't, you know, go over all the stats and everything like that because it was like a 3-minute piece. It was quite long. Basing on everything, obviously things that help him are Rookie of the Year, MVP, 3 World Series titles, you know, Gold Gloves, Silver Slugger Awards, all those things. He certainly should have the longevity in terms of number of years played, despite, you know, taking 2020 off and having, you know, the 2011 season cut short because of the injury. But, you know, he has kind of the requisite number of games or will. But the question is the decline in his offensive production over the last 4 or 5 years make him unworthy of the Hall of Fame at this point? Like, if he were to retire right now and then he was eligible in 5 years, I don't think he would make the Hall of Fame. Certainly not the first couple years of his eligibility.
Would you even vote for him yourself? Because I don't think I would.
No, I wouldn't. I think, you know, in 5 years, you'd have a little bit more of a step back because you're going to see the complete career of Yadier Molina and really be able to think about this in the sense of like how the position of catcher has been evolving in the major leagues. You know, you don't have guys catching 150, 160 games anymore. But yeah, it's just one of those things where even though his career average is still what 302 or whatever, so his career average is there, but his power numbers are just way, way, way down. I mean, they're that of a kind of a light hitting infielder at this point. And so I just wonder if that hurts him too much, despite that his defense has not declined. In fact, a lot of his defense has actually gotten better in terms of throwing out runners and things of that nature. So, you know, mind-wise, intellectually-wise, and even his arm and everything else has been fine. It's just really the raw power. And a lot of that was, you know, partly was the 2011 injury, although he came back and won MVP, so you can't really say that too much. But certainly the hip issue, right? The hip issue was a big deal. It has been a big deal for him in terms of driving the ball. And after his surgery, you know, he came back in 2019, everyone's like, oh, he's going to have a great year. And it was like, nope, not so much. So I don't know if having a full year off and, you know, being able to not rehab, but work it out on his own pace and maybe with a more structured program, if he's going to recapture any of that power. I doubt it because of age and just general decline as catchers go. But yeah, it's interesting. I'm definitely pulling for him, you know, to maybe push out a couple of extra seasons. I mean, clearly, I think we already talked about this last episode. This is going to be his last season in San Francisco. I don't see him with Farhan leading the ship here. He just doesn't sign, you know, these older guys. You know, it's kind of like the Bill Walsh mentality. It's to be like, you're still good enough for the major leagues, but you're just not going to be on our team anymore. We got, you know, other guys like Bart and company coming up. So, you know, this is probably his last hurrah with the Giants, and I'm sure he'll stick with another team or several teams over the next 2 or 3 years. And I really do hope for his sake that, you know, he puts up some okay numbers to kind of increase that longevity to, like, I think he's at 140 homers. You know, maybe he can cross 175. Maybe he can approach 200 if he plays long enough and kind of get to those numbers where you're like, okay, for a catcher, you're in the Hall of Fame. You know, not for an outfielder, but certainly for a catcher.
He's going to need like 5-6 years because, I mean, he hit only 12 home runs combined between 2018 and 2019, and that was in 219 games. So he hit 12 home runs the year before in 140 games. I thought Buster was going to be the kind of guy – oh, interesting. I thought Buster was going to be the kind of guy to hit 20 home runs, and now he's got to hit 15 if he wants to keep up any kind of power pace for Hall of Fame numbers. But I'm with you. I don't see him as a Hall of Famer just yet. John Smoltz at the end of the 30 and 30 claims that his bold prediction was that Buster will be back and he will be in Hall of Fame form again. So we'll have to see if that happens. If Buster has a season that puts him back in the Hall of Fame discussion, the Giants may consider resigning him. If he's willing to not get paid, you know, boatloads of money, he might re-sign with the Giants. That's absolutely still on the table, but he needs an outstanding season for that to happen.
Yeah. I mean, you know, Brooks brings up a point here. He says that he thinks Posey comes back to the Giants for two more seasons because they have $150 million to spend. I'm not saying that I don't think it's impossible. I just think, you know, if you're flipping a coin or if it's 50-50, which way are you going to bet? I'm betting that he's not coming back. You know, that said, you know, I mean, he had a really long, high paid contract. He seems like he's been showing, though, he is the type of person that money is definitely not the number one issue. I mean, he took last year off. He sacrificed whatever it was, $7 million to be home with his twin. So he's clearly not one like, you got to pay me, you got to pay me, you got to pay me. So I could see him taking a hometown discount if the situation is right. But is he going to sign for significantly less with the Giants if he can get twice as much with another club? You know, that remains to be seen. I would think
it's a hard decision to make for anybody, you know?
Yeah. No, it's a hard one. So, you know, Brooks also says the fan base would riot. Well, yeah, but I mean, that happens. I don't think Farhan has clearly not shown any, he gives a flying F about what the fans want. He doesn't care about that.
Here you go. As I'm going to mention, the fan base was rioting when Matt Williams was traded for Jeff Kent. So.
Yes, exactly. I mean, there's already been a lot of moves that Farhan made or didn't make that the fans have been upset about. And, you know, he literally, he doesn't care. He only cares about You know, he doesn't care about butts in the seats at this point. I mean, ultimately, that's what the Giants want. But if he brings a good product to the field, no matter who's on the field, if there's W's and they're in the playoffs, that's what's bringing the butts in the seats, or putting, you know, putting people in the seats. So that's ultimately, I think, what Farhan's MO is. And you know, I'd love to see him back, obviously. I'd love to see him back, especially if he really does transition into that first baseman type. You know, we have Brandon Belt coming to the end of his contract too, and we know, you know, he has long-standing injuries, and we'll talk about him. We could talk about him right now.
We didn't even put him in the show. Oh, you did. Oh, there it is.
I did. Yeah, Farhan, you know, yeah, I don't think he's bringing Belt back. So there is that avenue. Maybe they explore Buster being more of a full-time first baseman. You know, and Trump and company and Bart take over. Well, I'm saying Trump like he's long-term. He's probably not. But Bart and others take over the catching duty. So, you know, there is that avenue, and we've seen other catchers do it. You know, Piazza and others have transitioned and had successful time, and maybe less wear and tear on the body would be good, especially when you don't have Boach there anymore. Boach, of course, always loved him, you know, being catcher. And he will be catcher this year. I mean, it's been set, so.
Okay, so you mentioned Brandon Belt. We found out he had COVID in January, and then found out that he had mono, which is the sickness that he was felled with that we talked about last week on the show, and that he is finally taking batting practice now, but is questionable for opening day.
Yeah.
I think it's fascinating that we learned this after the fact. I don't really care. I just hope Brandon's healthy. You know, I mean, the man had COVID, and you want anybody who has COVID to be able to come through and healthy and good. So, you know, that does suck. But I was going to ask, didn't Brandon Belt have mono some other time, or am I thinking of somebody else?
Yeah, I don't recall that. I'm not sure. But what a double whammy for Brandon Belt. he gets COVID, and then right after that he gets mono. I mean, that's gonna wipe you out. Yeah. Jeez. No, that's so yeah, he's questionable for opening day. I think anybody would be questionable for life after getting that double whammy. I love the guy. He is such a character, and I think he's, you know, obviously very committed to the team. He just seems to walk into walls and stub his toe and catch random sicknesses. I kind of feel bad for him. He's just like, he's kind of the Giants clown or jester, I'd say at this point. Oh man, it's rough.
But, well, the odds of this happening to him have to be about the same as the odds of him getting hit in the head with a baseball and getting a concussion, which is something that has also happened to him. So yeah. Brandon Belt is a man who defies the odds.
He is. I don't know. Maybe he should buy a lottery ticket. Oh, what's the worst right. that could happen? He gets a paper cut or something. Then it gets infected and he loses his finger, I guess. I don't know. All right. So you put in the show notes. Let's check on some guys' stats, how they're doing. Why don't you go ahead and take that?
I figured we're a couple weeks in. We have a couple weeks out. So let's just check in on some of the names that everybody knows. And I did not go into pitchers. I just went into hitters here because pitcher stat lines are just so skewed at this point. Although we will talk about one pitcher in a little bit. So we'll check in on some of the regulars. Yastrzemski is 4-for-17 so far, which is a .235. He has popped a homer. He's walked twice and struck out 4 times. Donny Barrels has continued to be Donny Barrels. He is 8-for-16, which is obviously a .500 batting average. His OPS is 1.329, which is just ridiculous. It's not going to be sustained, but hey, a man can dream. And he's got one double, one homer. And here's the best stat about Donovan Solano so far. In 16 at-bats, and I didn't write down his walk, so I don't know how many plate appearances. He hasn't struck out yet. Wilmer Flores, the Giants team leader in home runs from a year ago, is 6-for-15 so far, which is .400. He also has a monstrous 1.433 OPS. I get a kick out of how big the numbers are, so I put them in.
Oh, I know. Yeah, they're funny right now. Barry Bonds.
He's like... got right. They all look like Bonds. He's hit two. I mean, when you got 4 extra base hits out of your 6 hits, because he's got 2 doubles, 2 homers for Flores, then you're gonna have a huge OPS. And he's struck out 4 times, and he's also walked 3 times, which is good to see. And then I jump back. Longo, he's coming off, what was it, I think, a foot injury. He's batting .455 though. He looks good. He's got a double. He's got a homer, and every at bat that I've seen of him, he looks good so far. Yeah, I mentioned Buster Posey has only gotten 12 at bats, and he only has 3 hits. He's got 4 walks, but he struck out 5 times in those 12 at bats. So Posey has not come around just yet, I guess is the best way to put it. And then Dick, yeah. I figured we'd throw Dick in there. Dick is 2-for-12 with a 167 batting average.
I just throw Dick in there, you know, whatever.
You gotta throw the Dick in there when you're talking about the San Francisco Giants. You know, he is the Giants' Dick. He's 2-for-12. He's walked 3 times, but he's also struck out 3 times. So there's not much from him. So I just figured we'd check in on some of the regulars because those are guys we know are going to make the roster. And some of them, like Solano and Flores and Longo, have kind of ridiculous stats, while others like Yaz, Posey, and Dick are struggling a little bit.
Yeah, yeah, and I know a lot of people, you see it on Giants social media when they point out stats of people going, wow, this guy's on fire, he should be on the team, you know, being Ramos or whoever it might be. And it's like, look, okay, this is spring training, you know, pump your brakes. We have AAA pitchers, some AA pitchers out there. Pitchers are working on different things. They aren't necessarily trying to get you out if it's a veteran, right? They like to use this, obviously, as practice. And then ultimately, these are all extremely small sample sizes. Their at-bats totaling the spring so far is not even a full week in the major leagues, right? And all of these guys have several hot weeks throughout the year, a hot month, for God's sake. So, again, everybody just, you know, remember, we've had springs where Joe Panic hit 400, Brandon Crawford hit 400, and then proceeded to hit, like, 230 for the year. So, just saying, you know, this is spring, let's calm down. But that being said, it is nice to see. Speaking of being nice to see, Aaron Sanchez has been out on the backfield throwing. In fact, he had a 3-inning simulated game the other day, and apparently he was hovering between 92 and 94, so he peaked at 94, and he looked good. He is itching to get out to some Cactus League action, so why don't we go ahead and hear some of his interview right here.
Yeah, I mean, this was as close as you can get to game-like atmosphere. A couple other live BPs I had, we had the turtle on around us, and we had some of the nets behind us. So to be able to get, you know, fielders in the field, hitters, no turtle, kind of get that simulation of game action, it was something that I needed. It was something that I was looking forward to, and I felt great. Stuff came out of my hand good. Made some adjustments on the off-speed pitches that I needed to make, and if I'm pitching in a game 5 days, I'm very confident and comfortable for sure. The first 2 innings, I felt like the bounce back between innings were a little bit faster. I sat a little longer. That was the first time I've been out of the stretch in a really long time. So I think going 3-0 to Wade and then getting back to 3-2, I think that was definitely huge strides for me, just being that I haven't thrown out of the stretch in a really long time. So I think more of that third inning was a little bit of getting comfortable coming out of the stretch. Stamina wise, I felt fine. I felt like I could go another 4 or 5 innings. But I think the thing that I'm going to have to watch now that I just went through that is that in between innings, finding different ways to be ready to go when I get 8 pitches.
And you mentioned some adjustments with your breaking stuff. What kind of adjustments did you make?
I have a tendency to pull it more across the zone instead of like landing it in the zone. And so that was one of the things that I saw today is I was more back foot to a lefty and I needed it more over the plate. So just release point on that pitch is all that is.
Okay. So it was kind of sweeping out of the zone then.
Anyway. Correct.
Okay.
And more like having hitters in there, just getting that dialogue of kind of where I need to be with a hitter in there, feeling that again. So, like I said, today was pluses across the board for me, for sure.
All right. Good to hear from the man. We'll see if he has any blister problems this year. But he's one of those dark horses that I think that, again, if he stays healthy, he doesn't get that blister problem. He could be one of their most dominant starters. I think it's possible.
Yeah. It really is possible. And from everything that they were showing and saying, you know, Boris was touting his whatever 2600 revolutions per whatever, mm-hmm. and you know, he if he's hitting upper 90s, the blister issue was something I didn't know about, and I actually was alerted to that the other day. And you got to hope that coming out of this three-inning simulated game, he's feeling healthy today, because I believe it was yesterday that he threw it. So, of course, he's going to feel like he can go four more innings when he just was out there throwing the ball. You know, we all get that adrenaline spike. So I'm with you, though. If Sanchez does that, he's also the kind of guy that's going to start out as like a fifth starter, but could creep his way up the rotation as the season progresses. I mean, that's a pretty good three-headed monster. If you get if Cueto's back this year, and then you got Gausman at the top of that rotation, Gausman, Sanchez, and Cueto, that's a pretty good three-headed monster at the top of the rotation. The Giants' rotation would not be one to sleep on.
No, I mean, like you said, if everything goes according to plan and these guys are relatively healthy, I think those three could be, you know, definitely above average for a top three in your, you know, rotation. You know, they're not going to be at the very top. They're not going to be probably the Padres or the Dodgers, but we all know that. But hey, you know, if these three can get in there and throw a solid game and be above 500 by themselves, I mean, it gives the Giants a fighting chance to stay, you know, close to 500. And so I think that's what, you know, should be giving Giants fans a lot of hope and excitement, not to take the NL West. Unless I think all three would have to be at Cy Young level for the Giants to even sniff the West.
Well, here's the thing. One of these years, here's the thing that I totally discount it to 100%. But here's the thing. One of these years, some team is going to get hot. And they're just going to blow past the Dodgers and win the division and take it back. And it's not like they'll take it back forever. It'll just be a blip in the radar. But one of these years, one of these teams like the Diamondbacks or Giants are just going to get scorching hot and win the division. I don't think it counts that the Padres do it because of all the moves they made this offseason. But yeah, somebody like the Giants or the Diamondbacks would do it. And we always, you know, we forget about those surprise division winners. We chalk up the Dodgers as winning the division, granted, won them eight straight times, so that's necessary.
That's it, you know, only eight straight divisions, no big deal.
But one of these years, somebody's got a surprise, and I'm not saying it's going to be the Giants this year, but I think my optimism is a little there right now. I mean, when we're talking about a good rotation, we talk about depth and all sorts of, you know, everybody behind those guys I listed stats for earlier has been hitting the ball well. So, you know, you think about the depth that the Giants now have and, like, why not them? And suddenly you can start talking to yourself into, well, maybe this is a team that could start causing some trouble.
Oh, don't start drinking the Kool-Aid too much here. You know, it's been spiked there, Erica. Spring training does that often, you know. Hope springs eternal. It's like, we're all 0-0. The Giants got a chance. You know, a month in, we're like, oh, well, so much for that. But no, well,
right now,
we'll
I'm
see.
Like 92 wins. We'll see. No.
Woo! Oh, no. Yeah, we got to revisit last year. I know. Kind of off on that. But
we got 2 weeks till we do that one.
We got 2 weeks till we do that. That's right. Okay, so we're kind of nearing the end of the podcast, but we have a couple things to talk about. One of them is minor league rules this year. Specifically, I guess it's going into double A, right? So why don't you go ahead and review it? Because I heard this a few days ago and I was like, hey, look, I know the minor leagues are for experimentation. Some of these are weird, man.
Yeah, they are. First of all, I'm opening it up right now. Let's see, what did you write down here? Defensive shift rule. That's double A. What's the triple A rule? The triple A rule is the bases. They're expanding the bases by 3 inches each and have a slightly less slippery surface on them. I don't know what that necessarily entails. But
just covering with sandpaper? I mean, what are you going to do?
Right,
you know?
They felt the need to include that in the press release. So, you know. In AA, they are having a shift requirement where all four infielders have to have their cleats within the outer boundary of the infield dirt when a pitch is delivered. And if they don't, it is a ball on the batter or the result of the pitch, whatever it is more in favor of the team at bat. Mm-hmm. And it's just kind of crazy to think about. And based off of that, they're thinking about for the second half of the season, forcing the field, drawing an imaginary line in the middle of the field and saying only two guys can stay on one side and only two guys can stay on the other side. They're going to base that, though, off of how this first rule goes. So they are now regulating the shift. And I don't know. Should we stop here and talk about this specific rule? Because, I mean, I'm totally cool with the larger bases. I think that'll create some more action. I think it'll be kind of fun, actually. But requiring the infielders to stay on the infield dirt, I hate it. I hate it. I hate it. I don't like it at all. What do you think?
Yeah, I don't like it. I don't like it at all. And what's really interesting is hearing a lot of longtime players and broadcasters and other people have completely different views on this. I'm actually kind of shocked about it. It's quite different. For one, Buster Posey is all for eliminating the shift. He would love it. But guys like Mike Kruko are 100% against it. And you'd almost think it would be flip-flopped in terms of like old school and new school. But that's their opinions on it right now. Look, I believe that, and maybe it is an old school opinion, even though the shift is relatively new, because, you know, there were shifts back in the 50s and 60s, but they were minor and they were singular to a player. You know, they weren't all the time. They didn't have the advanced metrics that they do now. But hey, you know, they're using the data that they have and positioning players where they have the highest percentage chance to get that person out. If someone's routinely hitting it up the middle or in the hole or, you know, loops it into right center field more often or is a strictly a pull hitter 75% of the time, those kind of stats and odds will tell you, okay, well, frick, put your second base in shallow right field, shift your shortstop over to second base and put your third baseman in the shortstop is, right? But the beauty of it is that the batter and the offense has a chance to adjust right back, right? You know, I think it's harder to say, oh, just slap it down the third baseline. Okay, guys throwing 100 miles an hour. But certainly they could work on things like bunting, right? And situations like that. I mean, there's already been a couple games this spring where you've seen some guys do that in spring training. They're working on their bunting with the shift over, you know, third baseman's over at shortstop. And it's been working. And so I just don't like having to tell players you have to play here or you cannot leave this area of the field. I think if a team wanted to put all seven fielders into right field for one batter at the end of an at the end of a game because they're trying to win it, let them do that. If it helps, great. If it doesn't, they get burned. Whatever. That's baseball. Part of it is strategy. So I don't like this banning of the shift. I know that the argument is for it is that if we ban the shift, it'll increase offense. And that's what the fans want. That's my opinion is I don't want that. I want to see strategy. I want to see when the shift works and when batters can work against the shift. I like that cat and mouse game. So I'd say leave the fields open, do what they want. But again, this is experimentation. It's just for AA right now, and we'll see how it goes. But baseball over the last few years really has been a lot more progressive in terms of, you know, changing rules and dimensions and all sorts of things like that. Well, I shouldn't say dimensions. That's always been there. But certainly changing rules. And, you know, this is part of it. What are you going to do? You know, I hope I don't want to see it in the major leagues, but we'll see.
Here's my thought. You're never going to tell a hitter, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to hit to right field. But you're going to tell a fielder, I'm sorry, you're not allowed to play over in this position. So you're telling one side of the ball, you can have your own regular advantage, but the other side of the ball doesn't get their own strategic advantage. And I think that's really what grinds my gears, I guess is a good phrase for that, you know, about this rule. That's what really pisses me off, is you can't regulate defense. You look at any sport, football, basketball, hockey, soccer. If the defense all wants to run to one particular, just like the example you used, wants to run to one exact particular part of the field and let the offense do whatever they want to do, they can do that. They're allowed to do that because it's within the rules. And it wouldn't be good strategy-wise, but the game dictates what rules should be there. And I think that this is coming in and dictating the rules that should be, instead of letting the game dictate the rules should be there. Plus, I pray for the second baseman of baseball that have to stand in the infield and face Joey Gallo screaming line drive. because I couldn't imagine just standing there and seeing a ball coming at me in the infield, you know? Like, I don't know about you, but playing, I've played at third, I've played second, you know, I played short, but not as much there. You get the screaming line drive sometimes, and you're kind of like ducking out of the way at the same time as you catch the ball. You know, that's what we're going to be seeing from infielders on line drives.
Yeah. I don't have Buster's quote in front of me, but I was reading it this morning, and he basically said, for example, Brandon Crawford, if we have a scouting report that a guy hits up the middle, but he has to play to the left of second base and he hits it up the middle, you'll see him make an exciting diving play and show off his arm. But if he's playing behind second base or on the right side, it's just going to be a routine ground ball. So that's why he doesn't like it. I thought that was an interesting, it was like from a fan's perspective, actually. I was like, well, yeah, it's great to see Brandon Crawford dive and throw a guy out. That's fine. But maybe I would rather get the sure out with just having a ground ball right at him as a Giants fan. I mean, that's like a guaranteed out versus like, I don't know if he's going to get to that. Oh, he did. Okay, he's going to do that one out of three times. So, yeah, I thought that was an odd, you know, opinion. I'd love to explore with Buster further on that one.
Great plays are going to materialize regardless. We don't need to force it, Buster. That is such an old school look. So that was the rule that has faced the most derision, I would say, from people like you and me. In single A, they're requiring in all high A that pitchers must step off the rubber to attempt to pick off. So they must disengage the rubber. So when a lefty is doing his leg and then lean and go to first, he can't do that anymore. He has to step behind the rubber now and disengage before he throws over. Plus, in low A, they're limiting it to two pickoff attempts per plate appearance. Now, I don't know how you do that. If you're the pitcher, if you throw over once, then you hold the other one in your back pocket. Is it more advantageous to throw over, or is it more advantageous to make the runner think you might throw over? I don't really know where that one goes to play in strategy just yet.
Yeah, I think that one's an interesting one. It doesn't fundamentally alter the game. Again, it's coming again from that, okay, are you just old school for the sake of old school, or are you old school because you really like the way it was? Like, there's a specific reason. Well, the defensive shift, I just explained why I like it the original way. This one I'm a little bit more amenable to, because in a way speed has been diminished from the game. And now, what is it, 80% of at-bats end in a strikeout, a walk, or a home run, right? I mean, that's most of the game now. Is it's not get them on, get them over, get them in. It's strikeout, strikeout, home run. Hey, we scored a run. That's just like get them on, get them over, get them in. Stolen bases are way down over the years. So I think this is an encouragement to players and teams that have speed and twitch to go ahead and take advantage of it. Because from a lefty's pitcher's perspective, like you said, I mean, they could always raise that right leg and then throw directly to first. And you always have to be honest over at first base. I remember I was, you know, when I would lead off in first base against a lefty, it was the worst because you also don't know if the umpire is going to call if the knee broke the threshold, right? That kind of stuff. And you'd see guys get away with it. And you see it even in the major leagues where guys are not stepping directly to the bag. They're stepping kind of at a 30, 40 degree angle, kind of almost halfway, and they're not getting called for a box. So, you know, you have those issues as well, where it's kind of unfair in a certain way, in one opinion. If you have to make them step off, that certainly increases the runner's lead right off the gate. I mean, right out of the gate, runner's got an extra full step right there. So he's going to have a higher percentage of chance of stealing that bag against lefties. And then if you limit it to two pickoff throws, I think you bring up a good point. Okay, the first one goes over. Now as a runner, you're like, okay, I know he only has one left. Now, if I were him, I would only use it if he was certain he could pick me off, right? So I'm going to go ahead now. I'm going to take a half step. I'm going to squeeze another foot or two out on my lead and bait him into that second throw, you know, just see what he does. And maybe the pitcher's like, oh, he's got a little extra. Oh, I think I could get him. He doesn't get him. Now he doesn't have any pickoff throws. And now as a runner, you're like, well, crap. Now I can get an extra full step. Or even more. I mean, because now you have to, I mean, you can't. I mean, what? So my question, and I don't know, I didn't read this far into it. So Eric, what happens if you have used your two pickoff throws, right? You can't pick the guy off. So now as a runner, how far can you lead if he cannot throw over to first? What's the physical limitation? I mean, could you practically, let me put it this way. You're a runner on first. He's used his two pickoff throws. You always had like an 8-foot lead. Well, can you just go 20 feet off the bag? The guy can't throw to first base. What can he do?
Yeah, but the catcher still can. And you need to
consider
your secondary lead, I think, in that situation. I think that's still your boundary, is how far you can go on your secondary lead without getting thrown out by the catcher, diving back into the base. That's the limitation you have to test. And I think that will reduce the number of walking leads. A walking lead, actually, I can see more often than like just these huge jumps getting taken. Cause I could totally see getting a walking lead off the bag, knowing the guy's not going to turn around and throw it, and then just take it off like a jackrabbit when the ball gets hit. I think personally, as you know, somebody who's run around the bases a ton, I think that would be my better bet for getting myself going faster than to start out farther away and then take my normal secondary. Cause you know how it is, that first step you take in your secondary lead. Now, if you start your lead off 2 feet, 5 feet farther, your secondary lead's going to actually be shorter. So that's going to throw off your own rhythm. So I think that the players themselves will show us what works best.
Yeah, it's going to be fun to – well, I mean, I know it's in low A. You know, if San Jose actually opens up their park, because, I mean, now we can have 20%, right? So I'm actually interested in going up to the stadium here, which is only about 30 minutes from my house, and watching some San Jose Giants games this year if I can. And I would specifically love to see this because I would think – I mean, certainly you bring up the point of a catcher picking off the guy in first base, and we see it all the time if a guy gets too far off the bag. So if you have your secondary lead, is you're halfway to second, but you're not stealing the bag, you're going to be hung out to dry. So kind of in that context, I would think that once the pitcher's used up his two pickoff moves as a runner, you're not going to try and get a bigger secondary lead in lieu of being picked off by the catcher. You're just going to go. I mean, if you have any speed whatsoever, because you can get such a massive lead that would leave you vulnerable to the catcher pickoff. You'd have a much higher chance of just getting to second than getting back to first. So I'd think if those two throws have been used, you're like, I got a blank check to run. I can go, you know? I mean, so that's what I think is going to be fun to watch. You know, a guy like, you know, a heavy set guy who's not very fast may not be taking that opportunity, but I think an average speed guy, certainly to a speedster, he's thrown over twice. I'm gone. There's nothing he can do about it. He's got to commit to the plate right when he lifts that leg, no matter if he's a lefty or righty, the moment he lifts that knee, man, and you can have your initial lead can be a lot bigger after that, you know, that second pickoff attempt, right? Because he can't throw over. And so you're like, I'm exposed for the catcher, but I'm not because I'm taking off. So I think it's going to be
weird.
It's going to be interesting to see.
Could you imagine taking off on a lefty first move? I can't imagine taking off on a lefty first move.
No, but you could, because they can't. I mean, they've used the two pickoff plays, but of course, you know, their legs got to come off. Their foot's got to come off the rubber now.
Right.
Interesting stuff when you really dive into it. AAA expanding the bases, like the physical size of the bases by 3 inches. Okay, that's fine. It'll reduce the distance a player has to go by 6 inches. Okay. So, you know, when it comes to those bang bang plays, it definitely can make a difference. 3 inches on one end, 3 inches on the other, because you have a little bit more of a lead. But certainly to slide into second, your fingers are now 3 inches closer to the bag. So those bang-bang plays are going to be a little bit more in the runner's favor. So you are going to see a slight increase in stolen base percentages in AAA because of that. I think you're going to see a big rise in stolen bases in single-A because of that pickoff rule. I really do. And you know, not being able to throw over as a lefty. I think that's going to see a huge increase.
I don't like that pickoff rule. I mean, I get what they're trying to do, but you cannot take the threat away. The threat needs to always be there to the base runner. A base runner cannot get carte blanche to do what he wants. That's really what it is. And then they're also instituting an automatic ball strike zone in the Southeast League mm-hmm. in low A. And I'm not a fan of this. I'm an ex-umpire, so I'll never be a fan of this.
yeah, Robo.
It's funny because I look at all these rules, and as an umpire, I would friggin' love every one of these additional rules. I have no problem with any one of them as an umpire, except the automatic ball strike system. Because it's been shown to have flaws, that pitches that with the naked eye we know, you know, went around the strike zone, if just one little part of the ball nicks one little part of the zone, you know, the computer calls it a strike, where a human would never call it a strike. And those yeah. kind of glitches need to be worked out with that. So I'm not even curious to see what happens there. I just hope it goes down in flames. That's just my take.
Yeah, I was reading that, you know, the previous systems were based on a three-dimensional box, right, over home plate.
Right.
But now it's just going to be a plane at the front of the plate. So imagine like a plane of glass. So it's wherever that ball intersects that plane of glass is what the computer is going to call. Instead of the box itself, which, like you said, things can kind of move around or whatever, or clip the back end of the box and it would be a strike. So, but I'm fine with it being at the plane if we're going to be just talking about the actual zone itself. I'm okay with that.
I mean, if you're an umpire, you're looking at a pane of glass. You're not looking at a three-dimensional object when you're calling balls and strikes. You're literally yeah. calling from when it crosses the front of the plate. So you're not even thinking about how it could possibly cross that back point of home plate, because it's not even part of your own equation. And I think that is what makes it a major flaw, is that human knows not to call that pitch, but the computer didn't know that because of exactly what you were talking about, the three-dimensional way they did it.
All right, so as we wrap up here, we have another top five. Eric came up with his idea a few weeks ago. It's been fun. This week we went ahead and went with our top five infielders of all time. Now this is kind of like during our lifetime. So it's not going to be like, you know, someone from the 30s, no matter who might qualify. So we got our top five. I'll go ahead and start off. I actually have video of my number five.
If you get it, good. If you're looking away, don't swing at something in. He didn't. 2-1 to Snow. It's set by the right-hander. He kicks, he deals. Snow swings. High fly ball to right. Hit to the corner. Perez chasing to the wall. It's gone!
Oh, no!
It's gone! Snow has homered, and we are tied!
Oh, man.
Chad's one of the people that's cheering right now.
I was. I was there that day. I was there that day.
I cannot believe it. And neither do I.
That thing was so beautiful. I was up on the third deck down the left field line.
In their new home, the Giants have just gotten their greatest gift.
Look at this ball.
A Pat Bell Park
Boink!
Special.
Three How does this
foot fly ball that landed just inside the right field pole and just on the grating atop the brick wall. In no other park in the National League would that have been a home run.
Yeah, you Dusty was me.
He got all of it.
Every bit. Got all of it. Oh, man. That was, as I kill it there, that was, I know I've talked about it before. For one of the top moments at Oracle that I had been to, for sure, was what that was near the top. It was an incredible day. I mean, obviously the Giants went on to lose that in the 10th inning, unfortunately, but that was so much fun, especially because it was the first year in their new ballpark. It was my first playoff game in the new ballpark, and the place just went electric. I mean, they're down by 3 runs, for God's sake. And then, you know, JT Snow pulls a rabbit out of his hat with that ball. And you couldn't hear it on the video there, but live, you could hear the thunk off the metal. It was just so resonating. And that's how, like, you right when it went thunk, everyone went, oh, my God, it's a home run. It's tied. So, but JT Snow overall, you know, he's kind of my number five infielder in my lifetime. Certainly the best defensive first baseman I've ever seen in a Giants uni. You know, better than, you know, Will Clark, even though he's way up there on my list, of course. But just, you know, a good, reliable first baseman, above average, good personality, good teammate, even though he obviously had a good portion of his career down as an Angel, but still one of my favorite infielders of all time.
I loved JT as a Giant. JT was, he was a lot of fun. He was one of those grinders that you could get behind. So that's a fine choice.
Yeah, that was good. How about you? What's do you have him ranked here? Oh yeah, you do.
Yeah, I ranked him too. I will put Matt Williams as my number five. I'll go across the diamond to a third baseman who was with the Giants from 1987 to 1996. As I mentioned earlier, he was then traded away for Jeff Kent, and Giants history was altered a little bit. But he was a four-time All-Star with the Giants. He was second in MVP in 94. I still don't understand how he didn't win the MVP. He had 43 home runs in 1994. He was on pace to be the one to, you know, chase Maris's record, and then the strike shut him down. And he had three silver sluggers and three gold gloves as a Giant. And I just loved watching him. I loved watching him in the box. He was such a bull. And he would, like, get in there and he'd be this hulking figure. And then later on in his career, he started doing that thing with his chin on his shoulder to make sure he kept his head in. Sometimes he would put his jersey in his mouth to keep his head down. Other times you'd see him, like, pawing his chin against his shoulder, and it was just one of those things that you loved seeing as a kid. It was the type of thing that you wanted to emulate when you went out there in the backyard with your buddies, and that's kind of where, like, honestly, most of my list, well, half my list came into play, is guys that I just love for the sake of loving them. And Matt Williams was one of those for me. He was so much fun to watch as a Giant. I really wish he had gotten a shot in 94. It's really a bummer that 1994 robbed him of that opportunity.
No, for sure. In fact, Williams made my list too. I'll share him in a bit, but I'll go ahead and share some video highlights of Matt Williams since you bring him up right now.
There's a drive deep left field. Griffey's going to run out.
Griffey Senior.
Go diving after that ball and it gets by you down the line.
High blast by Williams and goodbye.
I mean, he was just a thumper, you know what I mean? And
homer, the 23rd.
We even had a lot of those over the years.
That was his 43rd home run.
Giants and the Foghorn sounds.
There's Todd Benzinger. Blast from the past.
And forget about the fact that he has missed some baseball. Matt Williams dives in. Benzinger tagged him out.
Yeah, four gold gloves, man.
By both Matt Williams and Todd Benzinger.
No doubt.
This ball's not hit that hard, but it's hit in a perfect position for Stocker. And Matt Williams, two steps on a dive. Now he gets up. He knows he has to hurry. Throws it a little bit up the line toward home plate. Good.
But he got him.
Yeah. Now, I'm sure our audio listeners love that they're just hearing highlights. But
but I
we're
mean,
watching them, man. They're so much fun.
If you've seen them, when you listen to them, you know what you're listening to.
Yeah, for sure.
You know? Well, here. So, your number four ties in nicely with my number five, so I'll let you go.
Yeah, so my number four, we actually just talked about him with the big trade. We were talking about Farhan, you know, maybe not, you know, bowing to the pressure of the fans, but certainly Brian Sabian earlier in his tenure as a Giants GM made a very unpopular move, trading the aforementioned Matt Williams to Cleveland for Jeff Kent. And people were absolutely rioting. I myself was one of them. I remember I was actually... where was I that year? I can't even remember. I wasn't in Alaska, but I remember I was traveling and I heard the news and I was outraged. I was like, how the hell can you get rid of this guy? Matt Williams is, you know, one of the best Giants, certainly of the 80s and 90s. And you want to give him away for this guy who's like, he's been all right, but he's not that great. Boy, did we not see what was coming. But yeah, Jeff Kent, as I bring up his work right here. Where's Kent? There it is. I have some highlights.
I'll tell my Jeff Kent story after these highlights.
And two again with the bases loaded.
It's against LA. I thought it was appropriate.
And there's a high drive into left field.
Is it a second grand slam? Yes!
The ball is crushed.
Yeah, no, that was demolished. There were so many highlights for Jeff Kent. I was going to bring up his two home runs from Game 5 of the 2002 World Series, but I lost that World Series, so I didn't do that. no, but Jeff Kent himself, you know, played only 6 years with the Giants, but he had 175 home runs. Think about that. Yeah. You know, Buster Posey's played 11 with the Giants and has only hit 140, right? He had 100 or more runs batted in every single year as a Giant. I mean, crossing 100 RBIs now is a monumental feat for any Giant, right? He did it all 6 years he was with the Giants. And then, of course, he was a 2000 National League MVP as well. So he just, I know there was some personality deficits, perhaps some issues with him getting along with Barry Bonds and others, washing his truck infamously. You know, hurting himself, those kinds of little things that superstars are going to kind of, you know, it's going to happen. But overall, I thought he was just a tough, gritty, blue collar second baseman. He was pretty good defensively. Obviously, offensively, there was none like any other. And to be honest, I still can't believe he's not in the Hall of Fame.
I agree with that. I was going to put Kent on my list. I hemmed and hawed over him. I'm not going to lie. I really did. He's just, he was one of those guys that performed at an exceptional, exceptional level when he was with the Giants. And not many guys can be said about that. That's what made that Matt Williams trade so worth it. Those 02, 03 teams, that doesn't happen without that trade being made in the first place. And I'll never forget Jeff Kent. It was 1997. It was his first year with the ball club. It was my senior ditch day. And for senior and high school ditch day, we went to Wrigley. I mean, duh. And they were playing the Giants that day. Out of all the times in the world for them to be playing the Giants, it was that day. Well, Kent got his ass kicked out of the game. And it was just absolutely hilarious because he, like, threw a fit in the middle of the infield. And, he, you know, he got tossed and Wrigley went nuts. And that's my Jeff Kent story because I fell in love with him that day. While all my buddies were giving me crap and everybody was giving me crap around me, but that was, you know, it was less than 2 months into him being a Giant. And to see that he had a passion for the game, you know, it was kind of there. And it always came through with Kent. You know, you knew that he gave a shit about being as good as he was. That's what he cared about most. He didn't care about, like, baseball the most. He cared about being the best the most. And that's kind of what made him a Hall of Fame player. It was that drive.
It was. No, he was great. It was sad to see him go, especially when he went to Houston, went to L.A., went to, you know, it was just like, oh, had to go to the Dodgers, really?
And he did well for the Dodgers. He still performed up until the end of his career.
No, he was good all the way up until the end. Yeah.
And that's, I'm hoping my number four on this list doesn't become a Dodger someday or do something crap like that. Right. I mean, could you imagine, though? All right, I got Brandon Crawford on my list. I will say I notably don't have Buster Posey on my list. I'll just say that right now. That was for no other reason than he just isn't one of my top few favorite players from this. He's great. I love him. But your favorite player is a little different than the best player.
Yeah, and that's what these lists are for us every week, right? It's our favorites for whatever reason. I mean, it could be someone who played, you know, got three at-bats with the Giants. But for some reason, we loved him, you know?
Dan Ugla, man. Woo! No.
Dan Ugla, what a career with the Giants. He was my favorite.
I mean, I just love the Crawford story. He's from Mountain View. He went to high school in Pleasanton. He grew up a Giants fan. There's the famous picture. He went to UCLA. Then he gets drafted by his childhood team. Then he becomes the starting shortstop of a world championship for his favorite, you know, team as a boyhood, everything about it. He's been an all-star twice. He's won 3 gold gloves. He's even won a silver slugger. And he's so smooth. I'll tell you what, I have a bit of a man crush on him in that I wish I could carry myself in the way Brandon does. He's just so smooth with his delivery on and off the field that I wish I could beat Brandon Crawford sometimes. So yeah. Crawford's definitely, he's number four on my list.
Now, it's funny because Eric and I had a lot of overlap in our last two lists. This one, we don't have as much overlap on, but all of these guys that he mentions that are on my list are kind of like, they were the bubble guys, right? They're like 6, 7, 8, 9 kind of thing. If like, they're definitely in my top 10. And it's hard because these are just subjective kind of like, maybe if you asked me in 3 months, the list would be slightly different without me knowing it, you know, to be honest, because some of these are so close for me. But yeah, Brandon Crawford, you know, DJ Smooth. I mean, he is just like, wow. Just one of the, absolutely the smoothest fielding shortstop I've ever seen in my lifetime with the Giants. And it's fun to look back on his, I think it was, he was with the Augusta Green Jackets when they did have that video of him showing all of his shortstop tricks. I don't know if you've seen that video from back in like
I came
2008 or something like that. Yep. Yeah. Eugenio Velez. Yes, absolutely. He's on my list. Thanks, Steve. That's awesome. oh my gosh. Can't get over that one.
Is that who's next on your list? Velez?
Yeah, Eugenio Velez.
I'll give it.
No. Oh, yeah. That would be awesome. No, number three for me was your number five, was Matt Williams. Again, yeah, like you said, 4 gold gloves, 30 home runs or more, 4 times. In 1994, we just heard audio clip of him hitting that 43rd home run that year. He was on pace to hit more than 61. Doesn't mean that he would have hit it, but he was on pace. And I don't know, it just would have been exciting to see if he was going to be the home run champ after, you know, if the strike had not happened. So, yeah. But definitely Matt Williams is probably number three for me up there. How about your number three?
I'm sticking with shortstops because I love me some Richie Aurelia. Rich Aurelia was, he's Brooklyn born and coming from a family that's New York based. Anybody that's New York born and then becomes a Giant, and it's just automatically loved. Joe Panik just missed out on being on this list for that reason alone. Joe went to the same college that my grandfather went to. Like there was, you know what I mean? There's favorite ties there, you know. Now, while Richie didn't necessarily do that, he was born in Brooklyn, like my mother was. So already makes him, you know, a big fan of my book. But he was productive for the Giants. He was with them from '95 to '03, and then came back again in '07 to '09. He primarily played first. But I was shocked to learn that Rich Aurelia was the 2001 NL hits leader when I was doing a little research, and that in 2002 playoffs, he had 14 RBI, which was a record for shortstops. I had no idea that he had done some of those things. I saw him hit a grand slam one time at Comiskey, and that will always just stick with you. So,
oh, that's fun. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, Rich Aurelia was just always high on my list. He's such a gamer. When I ranked my shortstops all time in Giants lore, I reached out to him to tell him he was on the list, and he actually read my piece and got back to me. It was nice. Really cool. Yeah. So
that's
Richie,
really, really cool.
Now he does his wine thing, and I know he works for the broadcasts, the pre and post sometimes. But Rich Aurelia, number three on my list. He was just a good Giant. He just was. He was a good Giant. And sometimes you just need those good quality guys.
Yeah, I was going to say, you know, it'd be great to go, you know, you usually say, I'd love to, you know, have a beer with this guy. I'd love to have a couple of bottles of wine with him. So since he does have his little vintner industry going on, that would actually be a lot of fun. Chris brings up that it really was a beast behind Bonds in 2001. It's true. When you hit, you know, in front of and certainly in front of Bonds, You know, you got some protection there, so you're going to get pitched to. And he definitely feasted off of that. I know there were some whispers of PEDs, but nothing ever came of that. And I think it was just purely hearsay. You know, it's like, what are you going to do? But, you know, the distraction certainly. Yeah, yeah, no. Who would care at this point? It's a little past.
Well,
all right.
With guys like that might have used PEDs, those are the ones that everybody forgets about. Like, you know, well, he might not have had a career if he didn't use PEDs. So we're just going to.
Yeah.
You
know. Sorry about my dad there.
All
right. I'm going to go to my number two. And here it is. No secret.
Scudero at second, Sandoval at first. The pitch. There's a swing. A long, high fly ball deep to left field. And upper deck! Goodbye! A grand slam for Buster Posey. The Giants have scored six in the fifth inning in this elimination game.
Full count, another 3-2 pitch. On the way, runners go again, and it is called strike three. The throw to third, the tag, got him at third. And it's a double play. The strikeout, and then Jay Bruce gunned down by Buster Posey, two away.
Oh, a risky play.
I still don't
know. That was just so, I don't know. I mean, could throw 1,000, you know, highlights, of course, for Buster Posey at you. Just, you know, 2012 being his MVP year, and that, of course, that playoff series against the Reds and then against the Cardinals and then that against the Tigers, where Buster Posey, you know, was really crucial, not only defensively, but hitting that grand slam off of Matt Latos, that red ass that he was just so satisfying in so many ways. And boy, did they need every run that game, right? They went up 6-0 in that game five, and they needed every single run, especially with that showdown with Jay Bruce at the end with Romo. But, you know, what can you say? Buster Posey, I know you said that he didn't make your list, but again, this isn't about performance. It's about our favorites. And so I've had the opportunity to interview him a few times. And, you know, he's been nothing but gracious. I know some people don't think he has the best, you know, personality and engaging kind of character in the world. He's a dry wit kind of guy. He really is. A lot of times he does seem boring. And there have been interviews where he just kind of just is like, why am I here and answering these questions? Or at least you kind of feel that. But a lot of times it's completely dry wit. He'll answer a question and then kind of do a side eye at you because he's playing with you. And so I think some of it doesn't come across TV too well. But, you know, he also takes the game seriously. So, you know, part of that is that he really is down to business. Kind of like, you know, when I was mentioning last week with Vogey, not wanting to talk to any reporters anywhere near his start, you know, even within 48 hours of his start. So, but yeah, Buster Posey, just because of his work ethic, and obviously his performance and some of the monumental moments he's provided to us over the last 10, 11 years has accelerated up to number two on my list.
You know, it's like you said, everybody on your list just outside of my list, everybody on my list just outside of your list. The other thing that I noticed, and I actually researched this, everybody that is not active on the list, so including I'm about to mention Crawford and Posey, everybody else is on the Giants Wall of Fame.
Mm.
And
we no, that's good that you looked that up. Yeah.
Because I started to suspect it as I kept seeing it when I was researching my guys, and I was like, well, he's got some guys. Let's go check him out. And it's funny. My number two is Pablo Sandoval. I think Pablo will also get his plaque on the Wall of Fame. I think Buster will. I think Brandon Crawford. All three of them will eventually have one. So it's kind of interesting that every one of these will. But I pick Pablo as my number two. I just love Pablo Sandoval, Kung Fu Panda. He's been a Giant from 2008 to 2014 and then from 2017 through 2020. And we know now he is with the Atlanta Braves. At least I believe he still is. I mean, we have highlights, career highlights with Pablo that include his 3-home-run game, which again, Chad, that's one of his games. 2014 Game 7, Pablo came through with 2 clutch base hits to drive in.
Yes, he did.
To drive in runs during that game. And then in 2009, he was second in the league in batting average. Pablo was a 2-time All-Star and the World Series MVP in 2012. And I found this interesting. His first ever home run was off of Levon Hernandez when Levon Hernandez pitched for the Colorado Rockies. And I don't ever remember Levon Hernandez pitching for the Colorado Rockies.
I remember him with the Nationals and other teams. I don't remember him with the Rockies either. That's funny. Oh, that's interesting. You know, it's so sad because I'm putting together this list, right? And I'm looking at like career numbers and looking at lists to jog my memory because I don't want to forget anyone, you know, per se, because I wanted to do my due diligence. And I admit I completely glossed over Pablo Sandoval. I'm not saying he necessarily would have been in my top five, maybe just outside of it. But he's just one of those guys, I honestly did not actively think about him during this. And when I saw him on your list, I was like, oh my God, how could I like miss him? Like you said, I was at the 3-homer game, right? I saw him as a San Jose Giant back in 2007 or 8. I went to go see him because he was the next big catching phenom coming up. And remember, he was coming up as a catcher. So I saw him catch that day. And I remember they had, you know, they had the strikeout beer inning. I forget what it's called. But if they struck out the number 8 batter or something like that, they designated one batter for the opposing lineup. And if that batter struck out during the beer inning, it was a free beer for everyone. It was awesome. And I remember that was the game that it happened 2 times, actually, and Pablo was catching. So it was so fun to see Pablo catching. He's the next Giants prospect. And then everyone's standing up for the beer batter. That's right. They called him the beer batter. And, you know, he struck out. And everyone goes, yeah, then starts running to the concourse to go get your free Bud Light or whatever. That's nice. It was fantastic. Great memories. But, yeah, and I've had a chance to interview him several times. Really fun guy. He just, you know, he laughs, he giggles, he tells good stories. Yeah, just so much fun. Definitely not your prototypical baseball player in terms of his physique, shall we say. Certainly Kung Fu Panda, but good call.
That's why, all right, that's why we get... he went on my list is just for fun. I'm going to let you give your number one last because I believe your number one is the best player of the group. So I'll let you reveal your number one last. My number one favorite infielder of all time, and I saw Chris mention putting him on his list as well, is Robbie Thompson. And it's partly because I played second base very young when I started paying attention to the Giants. I was playing second base at the time, so naturally I gravitated to Robbie Thompson. I tried to emulate his batting stance. Only Ryan Sandberg's stance that I emulate more than Robbie Thompson's. He spent his entire career with the Giants. I don't know if people knew that. He played for them from 86 to 96, was a two-time All-Star, won a Gold Glove and a Silver Slugger in 1993, which is the year he was also hit in the face by a pitch, and that probably changed everything about the rest of his career. He was cruising along, having a great year in 93, and it was like a week, 10 days before the season. And he got in the face by pitch, I remember. And he came back to play that final game against the Dodgers, but it didn't matter, you know, when you lose 15-1. And like I said, Robbie's on the Wall of Fame. He won the Willie Mack in 91. And when he retired, this I found fascinating. When he retired, he led all Giants second basemen in games, at bats, runs, hits, doubles, triples, homers, RBIs, stolen base, fielding percentage, and double plays started. Which is just amazing that he had the corner, and then Jeff Kent came along and blew up half of those stats. But it was just amazing. Well, that's what you say. Kent had 175 homers. Robbie led second baseman with like 140 homers over his career for Giants second baseman all time. And then Kent came through and just smashed right through all those records. But Robbie was my guy. He was the guy I fell in love with before any other Giant. That's just the way it is. It just, there's no other way to say it. I know there was, you know, Jeffrey Leonard and Will Clark and all these other guys and then Kevin Mitchell and the pitchers. But as a kid who started watching the Giants, Robbie Thompson was my guy, and he's number one on my list.
Yeah, no, for sure. What can you say? I mean, Robbie Thompson, I actually typed him in my list. He was originally in the top 5. And as I started filling in names, he just got pushed out. He was just one of my favorites growing up too, just watching him with Jose Uribe turning those double plays. Again, gritty, blue collar, tough, you know, second baseman, just fantastic guy to watch. And, you know, a lot of big moments, in Giants history, obviously not a whole lot of playoff experience for him because, you know, he obviously had, you know, it was 87 and 89 and stuff, but, yeah, you know, he just never had that opportunity to go all the way, but, you know, great player back in his day. That was interesting. Yeah. I forgot that he had set all those records and to think of how long the Giants have been around, you know,
right. That's
to hold
why
all
that's...
those records as second baseman is pretty impressive.
Yep. Just, and then to have just Jeff Kent in 6 years come along and demolish.
I'm going to do it half the time.
I'm sure Kent had more doubles, homers, runs driven in, hits, runs. You know what I mean? I'm sure he blew all those out of the water.
Yeah. All right. So my number one, I think for people who listen to this podcast, it's no surprise, but it's going to be number 22. And his birthday was just a couple of days ago. I think he turned 57. But I love, this is kind of epitomizes Will Clark in a play.
Broken bat roller towards shortstop, the shuffle, and Clark taking the runner out. Look out, here we go. Look out. And here come both dugouts.
I mean, why did Okendo smack him in the head anyways? He started.
And look at that slide. It starts at the bag.
Yeah, it did.
It's classic. Kendo kicks him and punches him in the head. Then Ozzie Smith gets into it. I remember listening to this game. I was not watching it, but I remember listening to it. It was fun to listen to. Candy coming in. There's Dusty. Get some ice. Got popped there. It was Roger.
That's some great stuff.
Was that Aldrete? Yeah, Aldrete was thrown out right after. Yeah. Mike Aldrete was my wife's favorite player because he was the best looking giant, the most attractive.
Should have had her do a list.
I know, right? Oh, there's Whitey. Anyway, I'll go ahead and stop that. Just a lot of fun to watch that. Again, our audio listeners, I'm sure, are like, we can't see that. No, Will Clark. I mean, come on. Number 22, my favorite of all time.
They'll remember that. Yeah, if they're of an age, they'll remember that.
Yeah, and like that clip showed, I mean, yeah, is it a dirty play? Well, it was allowed back then. Today, you would be suspended for that, but not then. Then it was totally allowed, and the players took care of their own justice. I mean, it was a lot of fun. To you know, kind of reminisce on the way baseball was played back in the day. You know, interviews with him, he still talks about that play and others, going like, you know, baseball, basically players are, pardon my French, but pussies today because they can't take stuff like that anymore. But yeah, just, you know, he never got nervous, you know? I mean, he just, no matter what it was, playoffs or not, you know, spring training game or game 162 of a playoff push. I mean, he was playing balls to the wall all the time, and he just epitomized, it was just one of those things, you know, you grow up, you always have your favorite player, and he just was in the right place at the right time in my, you know, young teenage life where I just glommed onto him. And, you know, I met him a few times at card shows and stuff. In fact, got him, you know, got a couple signatures from him. But I earned my Eagle Scout back when I was like 17 or 18 or something like that. And actually my mom at the time had sent him a letter, and he was notorious for sending stuff back. And so here's one of an 8x10 saying, you know, Chad, keep up the great work, you know, Will Clark. And then another one, this was about, yeah, congrats on becoming an Eagle Scout. Wow. There it is. All my best on becoming an Eagle Scout, Will Clark, you know, and I have a couple cards signed by him as well. You know, it was back 5-6 years ago. I had the chance to interview him finally, and that was a thrill. Pardon the pun. That was fantastic to also just talk to him a little offline as well, just kind of off the record. So that was one of my dreams coming true. You know, being able to do this podcast, being able to interview my favorite, you know, player of all time. It's a little nerve wracking. You know, it's like, do you tell him this? Do you not tell him this? You know, because like it's kind of awkward, but it was a lot of fun. So, yeah, Mike is asking about Joe Morgan. Yeah, you know, I'm 47. So, you know, I was born in 73. So Joe Morgan was kind of like, you know, phasing out.
Yeah,
his last year was, I think, was 82 or 83. What was it? Something like that. It was in the early 80s was his last year. And, you know, I was like 9 or 10 at the time. So there wasn't the time to develop that, you know, fandom or relationship with a player, especially at the end of his career there. And, you know, he wasn't with the Giants forever, obviously. But, yeah, it wasn't until, you know, Clark's first year was 84. I was 10 going on 11 that year. And so you could see how, you know, from 10 into my teens all the way to when I was 19 and 20. When he finally left the team in 93, or after the 93 season, I should say. So for the better part of, you know, my formative years, he kind of fit right into that age wheelhouse, I would say. Yep. Where you form those relationships with players. Like today, I could see, you know, a kid who now is, you know, 18, 19, being like Buster Posey, Brandon Crawford, you know, these guys, Madison Bumgarner is their number one favorite Giant of all time, right? Same yep. thing. It's just kind of where you grow up. So anyway, that's our list. So next week we're going to do top five outfielders of our lifetime. And again, not performance-based necessarily, although it certainly is related, but it's our favorites for whatever reason, being anecdotal, relationships, stories, just for any reason, you know, how good looking they are. I don't know, whatever. That's what my wife would vote Mike Eldredy number one.
Every time for every list.
That's right.
I can think of one guy we both might have on our list next week that might have played left field for a little while. I'm just speculating here. But I think we're both going to have Barry Bonds on our list next week.
Oh, I don't know. He didn't make the Hall of Fame yet, so I might have to put him outside of my top five. So
hold that against him.
Oh, man. All right. I know we went a little long today, but sometimes it's fun to reminisce, especially during spring training when it's not a ton of stuff is happening, but we want to come to you every week. I mean, this is our spring training, right, Eric? I mean, we're off the whole, you know, off season basically. So now we're just kind of warming our pipes up and getting notes ready before the show and kind of getting ready for the actual regular season when we're really diving into the meat of performances and stories from week to week. Right now, yeah, it's a little bit more fluff.
What I miss is watching the games and that being the research, you know.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
That's I mean, that's honestly when our job is easier, is when you have the games to talk about. When we don't, but you know, let's be honest, we're a long-winded podcast, so an hour and a half to talk about this, that seems about right.
That should be our subtitle: TortureCast: The Long-Winded Podcast. All right. Well, on that note, I guess we should get out of here to be a little more short-winded. All right. We are streaming this live on Facebook, so join us around noon or so every Monday. That's Pacific time if you're on Facebook. If not, this video will be posted afterwards on our Facebook page. That's TorchCast. Sorry, Facebook.com/TorchCast. You can also follow us on Twitter at TorchCast. You can follow us individually at ChadK21 and at 2OutHits. And of course, all of this stuff, our audio, our video, stories, articles, anything we produce can be found on our website, torturecast.com. So certainly looking forward to getting some media passes again this year, since I was able to attend last year during a pandemic without fans. Now that fans are going to be back in the stands, I'm hoping they loosen the restrictions a little bit and allow some more media in. Although that wasn't a problem last year. I was able to go to every game I wanted to. There just weren't many media going to every game. I think primarily because you can't interact with the players, right? It's all Zoom calls. And it's still going to be that way at the start of the season. They're still, I mean, the media still cannot interact with the players or coaches. It's still those different tiered levels. So don't expect anything other than potential Zooms coming in. But yeah, you got anything else going on, Eric?
Nope, not a bit.
No? I'll mention again, I am doing another podcast with TortureCast founder Willie Dills Gregory and two other gentlemen. Ty Asher, who's actually been on this show once before. We may have him on again. He's an Astros fan, boo, but he's a very, very knowledgeable baseball fan and has good pipes. So maybe we'll bring him out one of these episodes. Anyway, I'm on this other podcast called Hard Edition. We talk about everything from news to sports to politics to video gaming, pop culture, whatever. It's also another long-winded podcast. We go about 2 to 2.5 hours. Just four guys, you know, basically shooting the shit and having fun. So check us out over there at Hard Edition Pod on Twitter. You can find us on all of the podcasts except for Apple right now. We're having some issues with that. But you can find us on Spotify and other places. So check us out over there. Well, that'll do it. So for Eric, this is Chad. And we'll be signing off here from episode 216. We'll see you next Monday for episode 217. Until then, stay safe. Aboo.
A big thank you to everybody for listening to the Torture Cast, the podcast by and for fans of the San Francisco Giants. Follow us on Twitter at TortureCast. You can also like us on Facebook or check out our blog at torturecast.com. I also want to say thank you to Ashcon and Bailey for letting us use their song Feeling Like a Giant for our intro. For Ben Lee and Chad King, my name is Willie Dills saying, we'll see you next time.